Book 3, The Book of the New Sun. The sun rose, and because this wasn't the old kingdom out here, it was a mere ball of flaming gas. The purple night of the high desert evaporated under its blow-lamp glare. Lizards scuttled into cracks in the rocks. Ubastard settled himself down in the sparse shadow of what was left of the cephasia bushes, peered haughtily at the landscape, and began to chew cud and calculate square roots in base 7. Tepic and Petrucci eventually found the shade of a limestone overhang and sat glumly staring out at the waves of heat wobbling off the rocks.
"I don't understand," said Petrucci. "Have you looked everywhere?"
"It's a country. It can't just bloody well fall through a hole in the ground."
"Where is it, then?"
said Petrucci evenly. Tepic growled. The heat struck like a hammer, but he strode out over the rocks as though 300 square miles could perhaps have been hiding under a pebble or behind a bush. The fact was that the track dipped between the cliffs, but almost immediately rose again and continued across the dunes into what was quite clearly Tussaud. He'd recognized a wind-eroded sphinx that had been set up as a boundary marker. Legend said it prowled the borders in times of dire national need, although legend wasn't sure why. He knew they had galloped into Ephib. He should be looking across the fertile, pyramid-speckled valley of the Djel that lay between the two countries. He'd spent an hour looking for it. It was inexplicable. It was uncanny. It was also extremely embarrassing. He shaded his eyes and stared around for the thousandth time at the silent, baking landscape, and moved his head, and saw Djeli Baby. It flashed across his vision in an instant. He jerked his eyes back and saw it again, a brief flash of misty colour that vanished as soon as he concentrated on it. Some minutes later, Petrucci peered out of the shade and saw him get down on his hands and knees. When he started turning over rocks, she decided it was time he should come back in out of the sun. He shook her hand off his shoulder and gestured impatiently.
"I found it!"
He pulled a knife from his boot and started poking at the stones.
"Where?"
"Here." She laid a ringed hand on his forehead.
"Oh, yes," she said. "I see. Yes, good. Now I think you'd better come into the shade."
"No, I mean it. Here, look."
She hunkered down and stared at the rock to humour him.
"There's a crack," she said doubtfully. "Look at it, will you? You have to turn your head and sort of look out of the corner of your eye."
Tepic's dagger smacked into the crack, which was no more than a faint line on the rock.
"Well, it goes on a long way," said Petrucci, staring along the burning pavement. "All the way from the second cataract to the delta," said Tepic. "Covering your eye with one hand helps. Please give it a try, please."
She put one hesitant hand over her eye and squinted obediently at the rock. Eventually she said,
"It's no good. I can't see."
She stayed motionless for a moment and then flung herself sideways onto the rocks. Tepic stopped trying to hammer the knife into the crack and crawled over to her.
"I was right on the edge," she wailed. "You saw it?"
he said hopefully. She nodded, and with great care got to her feet and backed away.
"Did your eyes feel as though they were being turned inside out?"
said Tepic.
"Yes," said Petrucci coldly. "Can I have my bangles, please?"
"What?"
"My bangles. You put them in your pocket. I want them, please."
Tepic shrugged and fished in his pouch. The bangles were mostly copper with a few bits of chipped enamel. Here and there the craftsman had tried, without much success, to do something interesting with twisted bits of wire and lumps of coloured glass. She took them and slipped them on.
"Do they have some occult significance?"
he said.
"What's occult mean?"
she said vaguely.
"Oh. What do you need them for, then?"
"I told you, I don't feel properly dressed without them on."
Tepic shrugged and went back to rocking his knife in the crack.
"Why are you doing that?" she said.
He stopped and thought about it.
"I don't know," he said, "but you did see the valley, didn't you?"
"Yes."
"Well, then?"
"Well, what?"
Tepic rolled his eyes.
"Didn't you think it was a bit, well, odd? A whole country just more or less vanishing? It's something you don't bloody well see every day, for God's sake."
"How should I know? I've never been out of the valley before. I don't know what it's supposed to look like from outside. And don't swear."
Tepic shook his head. "I think I will go and lie down in the shade," he said. "What's left of it," he added, for the brass light of the sun was burning away the shadows. He staggered over to the rocks and stared at her.
The whole valley has just closed up, he managed at last. All those people.
I saw cooking fires, said Petrachi, slumping down beside him.
It's something to do with the pyramid, he said. It looked very strange just before we left. It's magic, or geometry, or one of those things. How do you think we can get back?
I don't want to go back. Why should I want to go back? It's the crocodiles for me. I'm not going back, not just for crocodiles.
Perhaps I could pardon you or something, said Tepic.
Oh, yes, said Petrachi, looking at her nails. You said you were the king, didn't you?
I am the king. That's my kingdom over...
Tepic hesitated, not knowing in which direction to point his finger.
Somewhere. I'm king of it.
You don't look like the king, said Petrachi.
Why not?
He had a golden mask on.
That was me.
So you ordered me thrown to the crocodiles?
Yes, I mean, no.
Tepic hesitated.
I mean, the king did.
I didn't, in a way.
Anyway, I was the one who rescued you, he added gallantly.
There you are, then. Anyway, if you were the king, you'd be a god, too. You aren't acting very godlike at the moment.
Yes, well...
Tepic hesitated again. Petrachi's literal-mindedness meant that innocent sentences had to be carefully examined before being sent out into the world.
I'm basically good at making the sun rise, he said. I don't know how, though.
And rivers. You want any rivers flooding? I'm your man.
God, I mean.
He lapsed into silence as a thought struck him.
I wonder what's happening in there without me, he said.
Petrachi stood up and set off down to the gorge.
Where are you going?
She turned.
Well, Mr. King, or God, or assassin, or whatever, can you make water?
What, here?
I mean to drink. There may be a river hidden in that crack, or there may not. But we can't get at it, can we?
So we have to go somewhere where we can. It's so simple, I should think even kings could understand it.
He hurried after her, down the scree, to where you bastard was lying with his head and neck flat on the ground, flicking his ears in the heat, and idly applying you vicious brute's theory of transient integrals to a succession of promising sisoid numbers. Petrachi kicked him, irritably.
Do you know where there is water, then? Said Tepic.
E/27, 11 miles. Petrachi glared at him from coal-ringed eyes.
You mean you don't know? You were going to take me into the desert and you don't know where the water is?
Well, I rather expected I was going to be able to take some with me.
You didn't even think about it.
Listen, you can't talk to me like that. I'm a king.
Tepic stopped.
You're absolutely right, he said. I never thought about it. Where I come from, it rains nearly every day. I'm sorry.
Petrachi's brows furrowed.
Who rains nearly every day? She said. No, I mean rain. You know, very thin water coming out of the sky.
What a silly idea. Where do you come from?
Tepic looked miserable.
Where I come from is Ankh-Morpork. Where I started from is here.
He stared down the track. From here... If you knew what you were looking for, you could just see a faint crack running across the rocks. It climbed the cliffs on either side, a new vertical fault in the thickness of a line that just happened to contain a complete river kingdom and 7,000 years of history. He'd hated every minute of his time there, and now it had shut him out. And now, because he couldn't, he wanted to go back. He wandered down to it and put his hand over one eye. If you jerked your head just right... It flashed past his vision briefly and was gone. He tried a few times more and couldn't see it again. If I hack the rocks away... No, he thought, that's silly. It's a line, you can't get into a line. A line has no thickness. Well-known fact of geometry. He heard Petrachi coming up behind him, and the next moment her hands were on his neck. For a second he wondered how she knew the Cathartes death grip. And then... Her fingers were gently massaging his muscles, stresses melting under their expert caress, like fat under a hot knife. He shivered as the tension relaxed.
Oh, that's nice, he said.
We're trained for it. Your tendons are knotted up like ping-pong balls on a string, said Petrachi.
Tepic gratefully subsided onto one of the boulders that littered the base of the cliff, and let the rhythm of her fingers unwind the problems of the night.
I don't know what to do, he murmured. Oh, that feels good.
"'It's not all peeling grapes being a handmaiden,' said Petrachi. "'The first lesson we learn is, when the master has had a long, hard day, "'it is not the best time to suggest the Congress of the Fox and the Persimmon. "'Who says you have to do anything? "'I feel responsible.' "'Tepic shifted position like a cat. "'If you know where there is a dulcimer, I could play you something soothing,' said Petrachi. "'I've got as far as Goblin's Picnic in Book One. "'I mean, a king shouldn't let his kingdom just vanish like that. "'All the other girls can do chords and everything,' said Petrachi wistfully, massaging his shoulders. "'But the old king always said he'd rather hear me. "'He said it used to cheer him up. "'I mean, it'll be called the Lost Kingdom,' said Tepic drowsily. "'How will I feel then, I ask you? "'He said he liked my singing, too.' Everyone else said it sounded like a flock of vultures who've just found a dead donkey. I mean, king of a lost kingdom. It'd be dreadful. I've got to get it back.
You Bastard slowly turned his massive head to follow the flight of an errant blowfly. Deep in his brain, little columns of red numbers flickered, detailing vectors and speed and elevation. The conversation of human beings seldom interested him, but it crossed his mind that the males and females always got along best when neither actually listened fully to what the other one was saying. It was much simpler with camels. Tepic stared at the line in the rock. Geometry, that was it.
"'We'll go to Ephebe,' he said. "'They know all about geometry, and they have some very unsound ideas. Unsound ideas are what I could do with right now. "'Why do you carry all these knives and things? I mean, really?'
Sorry.
All these knives. Why?
Tepic thought about it.
I suppose I don't feel properly dressed without them, he said.
Oh. Petrachi dutifully cast around for a new topic of conversation. Introducing topics of amusing discourse was also part of a handmaiden's duties. She'd never been particularly good at it. The other girls had come up with an astonishing assortment— everything from the mating habits of crocodiles to speculation about life in the netherworld. She'd found it heavy going after talking about the weather.
"'So,' she said, "'you've killed a lot of people, I expect.'
"'As an assassin, I mean. You get paid to kill people. Have you killed lots?
Do you know you tense your back muscles a lot?'
"'I don't think I ought to talk about it,' he said.
"'I ought to know. If we've got to cross the desert together and everything—'
"'More than 100?'
Oh, "'Good heavens, no. "'Well, less than 50?'
"'Tepic rolled over. "'Look, even the most famous assassins never killed more than 30 people in all their lives,' he said.
"'Less than 20, then?'
"'Yes.
"'Less than 10?'
"'I think,' said Tepic, "'it would be best to say a number between 0 and 10. "'Just so long as I know, these things are important.' "'They strolled back to You Bastard,' but now it was Tepic who seemed to have something on his mind.
"'All this Senate,' he said.
"'Congress,' corrected Petrachi.
"'You, more than 50 people?'
"'There's a different name for that sort of woman,' said Petrachi, but without much rancour.
"'Sorry. Less than 10?
"'Let's say,' said Petrachi, "'a number between 0 and 10. "'You Bastard spat.' 20 feet away, the blowfly was picked cleanly out of the air and glued to the rock behind it. "'Amazing how they do it, isn't it?' said Tepic. "'Animal instinct, I suppose.' You Bastard gave him a haughty glare from under his sweep-the-desert eyelashes, and thought, "'Let Z equal E10, cud, 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 then DZ equals 1E brackets 10, D0 equals 1ZD0, or D0 equals DZ over IZ.' Pataclusp, still in his nightshirt, wandered aimlessly among the wreckage at the foot of the pyramid. It was humming like a turbine. Pataclusp didn't know why, knew nothing about the vast expenditure of power that had twisted the dimensions by 90 degrees and was holding them there against terrible pressures, but at least the disturbing temporal changes seemed to have stopped. There were fewer suns around than there used to be. In truth, he could have done with finding one or two. First, he found the capstan, which had shattered. Its electrum sheathing peeled away. In its descent from the pyramid, it had hit the statue of Hat the vulture-headed god, bending it double and giving it an expression of mild surprise. A faint groan sent him tugging at the wreckage of a tent. He tore at the heavy canvas and unearthed 2B, who blinked at him in the grey light.
It didn't work, Dad, he moaned. We'd almost got it up there, and then the whole thing just sort of twisted.
The builder lifted a spar off his son's legs.
Anything broken? He said quietly.
Just bruised, I think.
The young architect sat up, wincing, and craned to see round.
Where's 2A, he said. He was higher up than me, nearly on the top.
I've found him, said Pataclasp.
Architects are not known for their attention to subtle shades of meaning, but 2B heard the lead in his father's voice.
He's not dead, is he? He whispered. I don't think so. I'm not sure. He's alive, but he's moving. Well, you'd better come and see. I think something quantum has happened to him.
You Bastard plodded onwards at about 1.247 metres per second, working out complex conjugate coordinates to stave off boredom while his huge plate-like feet crunched on the sand. Lack of fingers was another big spur to the development of camel intellect. Human mathematical development had always been held back by everyone's instinctive tendency when faced with something really complex in the way of triform polynomials, or parametric differentials, to count fingers. Camel started from the word go by counting numbers. Deserts were a great help, too. There aren't many distractions. As far as camels were concerned, the way to mighty intellectual development was to have nothing much to do and nothing to do it with. He reached the crest of the dune, gazed with approval over the rolling sands ahead of him, and began to think in logarithms.
"What's Ifeeb like?" said Petrachi.
"I've never been there. Apparently it's ruled by a tyrant."
"I hope we don't meet him, then?"
Tepic shook his head. "It's not like that," he said. "They have a new tyrant every 5 years, and they do something to him first." He hesitated. "I think they elect him." Is that something like they do on tomcats and bulls and things? You know, to make them stop fighting and be more peaceful? Tepic winced.
To be honest, I'm not sure, he said. But I don't think so. They've got something they do it with. I think it's called a mocracy, and it means everyone in the whole country can say who the new tyrant is. One man, one...
He paused. The political history lesson seemed a very long while ago, and had introduced concepts never heard of in Djeli Baby, or in Ankh-Morpork, for that matter. He had a stab at it anyway. One man, one vet.
That's for the electing, then?
He shrugged.
It might be, for all he knew. The point is, though, that everyone can do it. They're very proud of it. Everyone has...
He hesitated again, certain now that things were amiss.
The vet... Except for women, of course, and children, and criminals, and slaves, and stupid people, and people of foreign extraction, and people disapproved of for, various reasons, and lots of other people. But everyone apart from them. It's a very enlightened civilization.
Petrachi gave this some consideration.
And that's a mocracy, is it?
They invented it in Ifeeb, you know, said Tepic, feeling obscurely that he ought to defend it.
I bet they had trouble exporting it, said Petrachi firmly.
The sun wasn't just a ball of flaming dung pushed across the sky by a giant beetle. It was also a boat. It depended on how you looked at it. The light was wrong. It had a flat quality, like water left in a glass for weeks. There was no joy to it. It illuminated but without life, like bright moonlight, rather than the light of day. But Pataclasp was more worried about his son.
"Do you know what's wrong with him?" he said.
His other son bit his stylus miserably. His hand was hurting. He tried to touch his brother, and the crackling shock had taken the skin off his fingers.
"I might," he ventured.
"Can you cure it?"
"I don't think so."
"What is it, then?"
"Well, Dad, when you were up on the pyramid, well, when it couldn't flare, you see, I'm sure it twisted around. Time, you see, is just another dimension.
Pataclusp rolled his eyes.
"None of that architect's talk, boy," he said. "What's wrong with him?" "I think he's dimensionally maladjusted, Dad. Time and space has got a bit mixed up for him. That's why he's moving sideways all the time."
Pataclusp 2B gave his father a brave little smile.
"He always used to move sideways," said Pataclusp.
His son sighed.
"Yes, Dad," he said, "but that was just normal. All accountants move like that. Now he's moving sideways because that's like, well, it's like time to him."
Pataclusp frowned. Drifting gently sideways wasn't 2A's only problem. He was also flat. Not flat like a card with a front, back and an edge, but flat from any direction.
"Puts me exactly in mind of them people in the frescoes," he said. "Where's his depth, or whatever you call it?"
I think that's in time," said 2B helplessly.
"Ours, not his."
Pataclusp walked around his son, noting how the flatness followed him. He scratched his chin.
"So he can walk in time, can he?" he said slowly.
"That may be possible, yes."
"Do you think we could persuade him to stroll back a few months and tell us not to build that bloody pyramid?"
"He can't communicate, Dad."
"Not much change there, then."
Pataclusp sat down on the rubble, his head in his hands. It had come to this. One son, normal and stupid, one flat as a shadow. And what sort of life could the poor flat kid have? He'd go through life being used to open locks, clean the ice off windscreens, and sleeping cheaply in trouser presses in hotel bedrooms.
This is, of course, a loose translation, since Pataclusp did not know the words for ice, windscreens, or hotel bedrooms.
Interestingly, however, squiggle eagle eagle vase wavy line duck translates directly as a press for barbarian leg coverings. Being able to get under doors and read books without opening them would not be much of a compensation. 2A drifted sideways, a flat cutout on the landscape.
"Can't we do anything?" he said. "Roll him up neatly or something?"
2B shrugged.
We could put something in the way. That might be a good idea. It would stop anything worse happening to him, because it wouldn't have time to happen in, I think."
They pushed the bent statue of Hap, the vulture-headed god, into the flat one's path. After a minute or two, his gentle sideways drift brought him up against it. There was a fat blue spark that melted part of the statue, but the movement stopped.
"Why the sparks?" said Pataclusp.
"It's a bit like flare light, I think."
Pataclusp hadn't got where he was today. No, he'd have to correct himself. Hadn't got to where he had been last night without eventually seeing the advantages in the unlikeliest situations.
"He'll save on clothing," he said slowly. "I mean, he can just paint it on."
I don't think you've quite got the idea, Dad," said 2B, wearily.
He sat down beside his father and stared across the river to the palace.
"Something going on over there," said Pataclusp. "Do you think they've noticed the pyramid?"
"I shouldn't be surprised. It's moved around 90 degrees, after all."
Pataclusp looked over his shoulder and nodded slowly. "Funny, that," he said. "Bit of structural instability there."
"Dad, it's a pyramid. We should have flared it. I told you. The forces involved. It's just too..."
A shadow fell across them. They looked around. They looked up. They looked up a bit more.
"Oh, my," said Pataclusp.
"It's Hat, the vulture-headed god."
Ephebe lay beyond them, a classical poem of white marble lazing around its rock on a bay of brilliant blue.
"What's that?" said Petrucci, after studying it critically for some time.
"It's the sea," said Tepic. "I told you, remember? Waves and things?"
"You said it was all green and rough."
"Sometimes it is."
"Hmm."
The tone of voice suggested that she disapproved of the sea, but before she could explain why, they heard the sound of voices raised in anger. They were coming from behind a nearby sand dune. There was a notice on the dune. It said, in several languages, "Axiom Testing Station." Below it, in slightly smaller writing, it added, "Caution, unresolved postulates." As they read it, or at least as Tepic read it and Petrucci didn't, there was a twang from behind the dune, followed by a click, followed by an arrow zipping overhead. Ubastard glanced up at it briefly, and then turned his head and stared fixedly at a very small area of sand. A second later, the arrow thudded into it. Then he tested the weight on his feet, and did a small calculation which revealed that two people had been subtracted from his back. Further summation indicated that they had been added to the dune.
"What did you do that for?" said Petrucci, spitting out sand. "Someone fired at us."
"I shouldn't think so. I mean, they didn't know we were here, did they? You needn't have pulled me off like that."
Tepic conceded this, rather reluctantly, and eased himself cautiously up the sliding surface of the dune. The voices were arguing again.
"Give in?"
"We simply haven't got all the parameters right."
"I know what we haven't got all right."
"What is that, pray?"
"We haven't got any more bloody tortoises, that's what we haven't got."
Tepic carefully poked his head over the top of the dune. He saw a large cleared area surrounded by complicated ranks of markers and flags. There were one or two buildings in it, mostly consisting of cages, and several other intricate constructions he could not recognize. In the middle of it all were two men, one small, fat and florid, the other tall and willowy, with an indefinable air of authority. They were wearing sheets. Clustered around them, and not wearing very much at all, were a group of slaves. One of them was holding a bow. Several of them were holding tortoises on sticks. They looked a bit pathetic, like tortoise lollies.
"Anyway, it's cruel," said the tall man. "Poor little things. They look so sad with their little legs waggling."
"It's logically impossible for the arrow to hit them."
The fat man threw up his hands.
"It shouldn't do it. You must be giving me the wrong type of tortoise," he added accusingly. "We ought to try again with faster tortoises."
"Or slower arrows?"
"Possibly, possibly."
Tepic was aware of a faint scuffling by his chin. There was a small tortoise scurrying past him. It had several ricochet marks on its shell.
"We'll have one last try," said the fat man.
He turned to the slaves.
"You lot, go and find that tortoise."
The little reptile gave Tepic a look of mingled pleading and hope. He stared at it and then lifted it up carefully and tucked it behind a rock. He slid back down the dune to Petrucci.
"There's something really weird going on over there," he said. "They're shooting tortoises."
"Why?"
"Search me. They seem to think the tortoise ought to be able to run away."
"What, from an arrow?"
"Like I said, it's really weird. You stay here. I'll whistle if it's safe to follow me."
"What will you do if it isn't safe?"
Scream."
He climbed the dune again, and after brushing as much sand as possible off his clothing, stood up and waved his cap at the little crowd. An arrow took it out of his hands.
"Oops," said the fat man. "Sorry."
He scurried across the trampled sand to where Tepic was standing and staring at his stinging fingers.
"Just had it in my hand," he panted. "Many apologies. Didn't realize it was loaded. Whatever will you think of me?"
Tepic took a deep breath.
"Zeno's the name,"
gasped the fat man before he could speak.
"Are you hurt? We did put up warning signs, I'm sure. Did you come in over the desert? You must be thirsty. Would you like a drink? Who are you? You haven't seen a tortoise up there, have you? Damn fast things. Go like greased thunderbolts. There's no stopping the little buggers."
Tepic deflated again.
"Tortoises," he said. "Are we talking about those, you know, stones on legs?"
"That's right, that's right," said Zeno. "Take your eyes off them for a second and... vazoom!"
"Vazoom?" said Tepic.
He knew about tortoises. There were tortoises in the Old Kingdom. They could be called a lot of things. Vegetarians, patient, thoughtful, even extremely diligent and persistent sex maniacs. But never, up until now, fast. Fast was a word particularly associated with tortoises because they were not it.
"Are you sure?" he said. "Fastest animal on the face of the disk, you common tortoise,"
said Zeno. But he had the grace to look shifty.
"Logically, that is," he added.
To everyone without such a logical frame of reference, the fastest animal on the disk is the extremely neurotic, ambiguous Puzuma, which moves so fast that it can actually achieve near light speed in the disk's magical field. This means that if you can see a Puzuma, it isn't there. The fastest insect is the .303 bookworm. It evolved in magical libraries, where it is necessary to eat extremely quickly to avoid being affected by the thalmic radiations. An adult .303 bookworm can eat through a shelf of books so fast that it ricochets off the wall. Most male presumers die young of acute ankle failure caused by running very fast after females which aren't there, and of course achieving suicidal mass in accordance with relativistic theory. The rest of them die of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, since it is impossible for them to know who they are and where they are at the same time. And the seesawing loss of concentration this engenders means that the presumer only achieves a sense of identity when it is at rest, usually about 50 feet into the rubble of what remains of the mountain it just ran into at near light speed. The presumer is rumoured to be about the size of a leopard with a rather unique black-and-white check coat. Although those specimens discovered by the disc's sages and philosophers have inclined them to declare that in its natural state the presumer is flat, very thin, and dead.